Welcome to episode 53 of the Payers and Players podcast. Today's guest is Alex Rybakov. Alex was the number one rated junior by Tennis Recruiting Network as a junior and senior in high school. After high school, he chose to play tennis at TCU, where he holds the school record for most career wins. He was a three-time All-American, as well as being the Big 12 Freshman of the Year and the Big 12 Player of the Year. He has four futures titles to his name, including most recently in Iowa City last summer, where he defeated John McNally. We really enjoyed talking with Alex and hearing his story about how he developed from, you know, a kid who was not, you know, highly regarded as a 12 and under player, but one that grew into, you know, the number one recruit in his class as a senior. So I hope you guys enjoy the story that Alex has to tell, and we hope that Alex does well going forward in his professional career. Please follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is Payers Players. Our website is www.payersandplayers.com, where you can find today's show notes as well as other interesting items. And if you'd like to email us, our email address is payersandplayers@gmail.com. Alex, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Hey, so tell us a little bit about your tennis background. I know that your dad is a tennis coach, but talk a little bit, about how, you know, you sort of got into tennis, and talk a little bit about, you know, how your junior development was from the beginning.
Yeah. So my family, my whole family is a tennis family. My dad grew up playing in Russia, playing the juniors, was a top junior. He traveled with Chesnikov, who was top 10 in the world. My mom grew up playing tennis. My sister, who's 8 years older than me, she played tennis at FSU. So I watched her growing up and playing tennis, and I obviously started from a very young age. So it's kind of in my blood in a way, and I started from a very young age. I loved it and just continued on through the juniors.
And where was that? Where did you get started? Was that always in Florida?
So I was born in New York. We lived there until I was about 7 years old, and then we actually moved down to Florida for my sister's tennis, because, as you guys know, Florida is a big state for junior tennis. Super competitive. So we moved down there for her tennis, and then I kind of got into it from there.
Okay, good. Yeah. So, you know, you raised the point about some of Florida sort of being, you know, a hotbed for tennis, and, you know, around people or other successful players around your age, you know, would be, you know, Stefan Kozlov, Sophia Kennan, and Amanda Anisimova, Naomi Osaka. Mm-hmm. Did you guys see much of them when you grew up?
Yeah. I actually remember the first couple of times that I was practicing at USTA. I remember Anisimova was hitting there and hitting short court for hours, and I just remember watching her. That was one of the things that stuck out in my mind, and now she's, you know, top 50 in the world. And obviously with Riley and Tommy and those guys, and USTA being in Boca, which was close to where I grew up, and eventually started training there once my results got pretty good.
Tell us about when you were young and you were getting going in the game. I know with your whole family playing, it was probably something that your sister would be practicing. You'd have a racket in your hand and you'd just be hitting off the wall or whatever. And but at what point did you start training on a daily basis? How old were you? And how did that progression kind of go as you became 10, 11, 12 years old?
Yeah. So, I mean, you nailed it there with the, you know, my sister, watching my sister practice on court, and I was just hanging around, you know, hitting balls. My mom would be missing balls, and you know, I loved it from a young age, and, you know, I was playing some tournaments, not obviously super competitive at 10, 11, you know, just the tournaments around Florida. 11, 12 years old, I played Eddie Herr, Orange Bowl, those tournaments, and, but I was still, you know, my parents wanted me to have a good childhood. I was in school. I was in elementary school, middle school. And then once I got into eighth, ninth grade is when I started getting, you know, pretty competitive. My results were pretty good. So you know, I was practicing on a daily basis, and ninth grade is when I just decided to do online schooling, because I was missing a lot of school, and that was just the route that I wanted to go. I wanted to be a competitive junior. I wanted to play those junior slams, and from my point of view, you know, in the 12s and 14s, I wasn't top in the nation. I wasn't really top in Florida. So seeing, you know, that, and then being 15, 16 years old and playing some of the lower level ITFs, I don't think I really was aware of my level and how good I could be. But, you know, my dad being in tennis for so long, he had a plan for me. And then, you know, I wanted to do that. So starting in high school, that's when I started getting really, really serious and doing online school and really going after it.
So what did it look like, say, at 10 and 11, though? So be more detailed, like at 10, 11, and 12, what were you doing?
Yeah, I mean, 10, 11, and 12, I was I'm not sure if I was hitting every day. I'm not sure if I was on court every day. I was on court probably a decent amount of days through the week. But, you know, at 10, 11, and 12, I was just really just having fun, just playing the tournaments in Florida. I wasn't really traveling. I wasn't going to those, you know, like Easter Bowl and the 12s and you know, Winter Nationals. It was all 10, 11, 12. It was everything in Florida around my house. You know, I was playing the small Super Series and those smaller tournaments, having fun with the guys that were playing those tournaments as well. You know, just kind of like a kid. I wasn't, you know, yeah. I obviously yeah. had dreams of playing professional tennis, but at that time I wasn't, you know, in the gym and doing, you know, I was just more like a kid having fun, you know?
So you're sort of building, you know, a love for the game, and you're developing, you know, your game, but you weren't traveling all over the country for tournaments and points.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
If things were in your backyard, like Eddie Herr and Orange Bowl, you know, you're playing because they were there.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, to put it into perspective for you, I was at 11 years old. I, you know, thought I was playing pretty well. Made, I think, the third round of Eddie Herr, and I lost to Kozlov 0-0. I remember in the 12th. So that, yeah. You know, that's where I was at that point.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think a lot of kids had similar results to him at that age too. I think I remember hearing like Riley lost him also 0-0 at that age at some point or something like that. So it seemed like,
Riley was, you know, like one of the guys that I've known since so it's, 9 years old, and we kind of went through the same thing, you know, at that age, we were just playing and he ended up starting to train at USTA a little bit younger than I did, but mm-hmm. it was kind of the similar story, you know?
Yeah. And so, you know, because your dad was your coach, did he do anything, say that was maybe unique or outside the box? I'm not sure when the whole red, orange, green progression came in, but I know that it's somewhat controversial and that Florida was sort of mandating, you know, you can't play tournaments until you reach a certain age, or stay in orange ball for a certain time.
My parents, I mean, I very much grew up in a European household, and my parents coming from Russian background, I don't really think there was any red, orange, green
right.
progression.
Right.
I think it was just
you know, tennis, right?
You go out, you hit with the, here's the U.S. Open regular duty, like you go out and at 8 years old and you just hit balls and, you know.
Right.
I would love to give some input on that, but I just don't. That just wasn't how it was for me. And, you know, that could work for other people for sure. But I honestly just have no knowledge in that area.
Right.
So at what point did it become more serious for you? So you're like 12, you're having fun, you're playing in your area, if something's close, you play it. At what point were you like, all right, I'm going to get serious, I'm going to get in the gym, I'm going to do fitness, and I'm going to go play tournaments, and I'm going to travel?
I think, you know, 13, 14, I was definitely playing every day on a regular schedule. And once I was towards the back end of middle school and onto high school, when I was 15, 16, I was starting to travel, play ITFs. That's when for me, I was really like, okay, like I really want to do this, you know, I really want, you know, to be a top player and eventually a top pro. And, you know, I was at 10, 11, 12, you know, I was thinking about it. It was like sort of like a dream of mine, but it wasn't really in my head of like, okay, I'm going to do this every day. I'm going to lock down. I'm going to work, you know, like at that point, I don't think mentally I was ready for that. But I think towards 15, 16 high school years, you know, 16 years old, I was already towards the end of 16 and 17, I was already training full time at USCA. I mean, my dad was still looking, my parents were still looking over me and helping me out for sure, but I was already practicing with the guys every day. You know, 16 years old, I was locked in. I knew what I wanted. So
what age did USCA pick you up?
I would say I started at 16 years old. I started going to USCA occasionally, you know, to practice and play matches. And then I had some of those wild card tournaments for futures. And I would say towards the end of, you know, closer to when I turned 17, my last 2 years before I went to college, 17, 18 years old, I was training full time at USCA.
Okay. So, you know, like I think Riley and Tommy, you know, they were at USTA from like 12 or 13. Is that right?
Yeah. I want to say like, yeah, like 13, 14. Yeah. They're definitely a bit, okay. Before I was, for sure.
Gotcha. Okay. So you came along after.
I knew those guys. I knew those guys and we were good friends, but I wasn't, you know, training there with them until a little bit later, until 16, 17. I mean, 16, we were seeing each other a lot, practicing a lot, traveling. But towards the end of 16, 17, 18, that's when I was there full time.
So would you change the way that, like, that you did it? I mean, I tend to believe that the way that you're doing it is probably smart in that it was fun. It was one of many things you did when you were young. As you got older, it became more serious as you got older. You know, I see a lot of these kids at 11, 12 years old, they're training like a pro. They're out there in the gym working, they're doing fitness,
yeah.
Playing yeah. 2-3 tournaments yeah. a month. And, it, you know, by the time they're 16, their body's either worn out or they're mentally just tired.
100%. Yeah, 100%. I'm a big believer in, you know, parents kind of being not as hands-on, especially if they don't know, you know, I mean, I'm lucky that my parents are both tennis coaches, so they know a lot about the sport, you know, but they were, you know, they really wanted me from a young age. Of course, tennis was very prominent in my life and it was everywhere around me, but they wanted me to make my own decision and to what I want to do from a young age.
What was your physical stature as a young kid? Were you bigger than everybody, smaller than everybody?
No. I was pretty lean. Like I'm definitely lean now, but I'm definitely stronger than I was. Like I probably gained through college almost 20 pounds. I mean, I was a skinny kid. I always was quick and I always moved well, but I definitely was not, you know, I grew late. I was definitely smaller than everyone else.
So did you see kids when you were playing that were just way bigger than everybody and beating up on everybody? But then as everyone caught up,
for sure.
Size, that quit
happening? You see so much of that. Yeah, for sure.
So give me, don't name names, but give me like a couple examples of guys that beat they were huge. And then all of a sudden
I see it now where, I'm at a future now. I'm playing my second round tomorrow. I'm at a future now and I see a guy who, you know, when I was 15, 16, I was looking at this guy like, holy shit, like this guy's a monster, you know? And he was top five in the world in juniors. And now he's, you know, he's been playing for 4 or 5 years and he's exactly where I am 5 months out of college. You know, I've played,
right.
I have, you know, I haven't even played a full schedule yet. I've played, you know, I've been playing 8 tournaments every year, 9 tournaments, you know? I mean, that's a bit of an accelerated example, but there's so many examples that I can name. I'm actually staying with the at the Opelka's house right now, and me and George were talking about, me and Riley's dad, we were talking about, you know, Florida legends. We have go through 10, 20 names of guys that were unreal in the 12s that me and Riley were like, oh my God, like these guys, how, like, the guy's going to be number one in the world, you know? Like, these guys are unbeatable. And then
right.
three, four years later, you know, we're beating them 2-2. And
yeah.
So.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about Riley, because he's obviously grown up to be a 7-footer. Was he always heading towards, but was he always that kid that was bigger than everybody growing up?
Or, I mean, you could tell, like, you know, both his parents are tall, are super tall, and
right.
He was always a big kid growing up. I mean, he's now, you can see, like, he's growing into his body, like, he's super strong. He's a strong guy, even for 7 feet. But before, obviously, he was lanky, didn't really know, was kind of clumsy of, you know, going through those years. But for his height, I mean, I think he moves great, and physically, he's very strong. It took him a bit, for sure, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think I read or heard that I think when he was 12, he made the finals of the clay courts, you know, when he was 12 years old. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was always good. Always.
So, to make clay courts, obviously a slower game. So you had to have some sort of, you know, coordination and ability to keep the ball in the court
to be successful at that age. I mean, Riley was always a great player. But I'm talking about, like, on a different level, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I got you. So you know, you said you go ahead.
I just think it's real interesting. So you're sitting there having a conversation with George, and y'all are talking about the kids that just destroyed everybody in the 12s, and now they're really not having a whole lot of success. Do you attribute a little bit of that to size, and then the other of it that there are these kids that when they're 11, they're taking it so serious, so they're developing a lot of skill early, but then everyone catches up to the skill. And then the second part of that question is, how much do you think the coaching matters in the development of the player, and how much of it is just physical body stature and talent and work ethic? That, because I think sometimes parents, especially with young kids, overvalue how much the coach is actually impacting their child's success.
I would definitely say that all of those things that you've named play a big role, from coaching to physical to work ethic. I would say all of those are definitely important, but at a young age, I think coaching is definitely important from, you know, no matter what age, but definitely from a younger age, I don't think that it may be as important as people, you know, put emphasis on, as some parents do. I think, you know, whether you have a certain coach, I think when you're just starting, like when you're setting technique and that kind of stuff, it's definitely pretty important. But, you know, I don't know, when a kid's 11, 12 years old, I don't know what necessarily a coach is going to tell you from a tennis standpoint. I mean, I think it's probably at that age is more important, you know, like kind of attitude and, you know, not throwing your racket every point. And
how did that go with you and your parents? Did your parents coach you?
Yeah, my parents coached me, like I said, until I was full-time at USCA, and they still were super involved, and they still are pretty involved in my tennis.
How did those coaching sessions go as you were young? And then what did they look like at 16? Did it get simpler as you got older, or more complex, or was it, you know, when you were 11, y'all just rallied? Kind of what did the practice sessions look like?
Yeah. Like I said, 11 years old, 12 years old, it was more of, you know, like rallying, having fun. I mean, going through everything, hitting volleys, hitting, kind of setting the tone a little bit. And then as the years went by, you start putting in a little bit more specific things, maybe like transition work, approach shot to volley, you know, doing a lot of movement stuff, two cross one line, three cross one line, two cross one line, you know, playing specific points where, you know, you start the point with the forehand inside out, and then you play it out, or, you know, play a game where you have to serve and volley a certain amount of times. You know, I think as your skill set grows, it gets, the practices get a little bit more specific, and then also specific as to what you need to work on, your weaknesses, your strengths, all that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that Robert was maybe alluding to in the previous question was when we talk about, you know, these kids that dominate in the 12s, is that really the game is a different game in 12s than it is in the 16s, or when you get into the higher levels of the juniors. Cause, you know, at 12s, it's really about not making errors. Whereas in, you know, 16s, and it's more about forcing errors and being more aggressive. And so is that something that, you know, you may have, you know, been a problem for you when you're at a younger
age?
Well,
I think at a younger age as well, for me, it was, I think I switched to a one hander at 11 years old, or 11 or 12. So that was always a challenge for me because, you know, me not being the strongest kid growing up from my age group. And, you know, I mean, you guys have watched a lot of tennis in 11s and 12s. There's a lot of, like you said, rallying and moonballing. And for me, hitting high, you know, high backhands with a one-hander, just switching, was extremely challenging. So that was something that was frustrating for me. But over time, that many high balls to my backhand, it's just made my backhand better. So,
I was just going to say, you know, because you said that you weren't necessarily, you know, ball to the walls at 11, 12. So you could make a change like that because you really weren't caring about, you know, if I do this, my ranking's going to suffer.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I've always been a extremely like competitive person, and I hate to lose. And I obviously want to win, but at the same time, I'm not, you know, like, it's not, well, if I lose a match at 11, 12 years old, my parents are not, you know, yelling at me and just saying, how could you lose this match, blah, blah, blah. It's, you know, and I wasn't thinking, oh, I lost this match at the end of the world. Of course, I mean, like, I was 12 years old, I'd cry, I'd, you know, I'd do all this. But it's just a different type of mindset. You know, I'm not, like, 12 years old thinking, okay, like, I need to win this match because if I don't, I'm going to move down in the ranking or move up. That stuff just didn't, at that age, just didn't really matter to me. And I think that that has helped, that definitely helped my development of those
things. Yeah, I mean, I think kids that, you know, win, you know, say every match when they're 12 years old, then they get sort of afraid to lose because, you know, the target's on their back and they're the ones that are being hunted. And the kids that, you know, are sort of below the radar, they're, I can go out and I can try this. And if I lose, it's, you know, I'm trying to win, but it's not the end of the world. But it's those kids that, you know, are super dominant at that age. I think they sort of get this mental block that, you know, if they lose, they can't try something new because then it's uncomfortable. Yeah. And then you're not really growing your game. And you're sort of peaking at a too young of an age.
I just think in general, it's, I think at that age, it's too early to tell, like, whether a kid is going to be, you know, top professional in the world in 10 years or not. I mean,
they haven't got through puberty yet. Right.
Exactly. Like, I'm standing here today, like, watching a guy, he's 16 years old, won the French Open last year, in juniors. Very good player, 16 years old, very good player, lost first round of the future, but, I mean, it's looking, and I'm like, okay, like, the kid's great. Yeah, he's great for 16, but, like, I don't know, you know, even at 16 years old, he's one of the world, but I don't know, like, it doesn't guarantee him anything.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, he's one of the world in juniors. He could he could get to 300 and then not do anything. He could be top 100. I mean, it's tough to tell. There's a lot of, you know, he's still got a lot of developing to do to get to that point. So, I mean, you're talking about guys that are kids that are 12. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
I just think personally when, you know, like people make a big deal out of course, like everybody wants to win. Of course, like, yeah, your kid wins Eddie Herr Orange Bowl. Of course, it's a great accomplishment. Unbelievable. Like, sure. Great. Yeah. Like, shouldn't right. take anything away from the kid, but does that mean that kid is going to be top 100? I mean, I have no clue. Yeah, like it could give him maybe a slight better chance because he's a good, you know, he's got the talent, yeah, he's got the hand eye, right. And all this,
and he'll get the recognition, he'll get the coaching, and get the, you know, the financial, you know,
exactly,
burden
exactly,
removed.
Exactly.
So it helps exactly. from that, but it's you know, like I say, it's always interesting that, you know, Richard Gasquet beat Nadal at that tournament, the La Petite Ace. And
yeah.
never beat, you know, he beat him in the juniors, but he never once beat him as a pro. And so it's just a different example.
Yeah.
Hey, I was curious, you know.
Go ahead, Scott.
Well, I was just going to ask, you know, you say you have your sister is 7 or 8 years older than you are.
Mm-hmm.
How did your parents approach, you know, her development versus yours? I mean, you know, there's, you know, the difference in gender, 7, 8 years.
Yeah.
Were they, maybe they're, you know, because the second time going through, they learned, hey, you know, it's not a race to the 12s. So they took things slower with you, or is there something that you may have picked up on that they learned that to do differently with you than they did her, or were there things like that?
I think it was pretty similar, but I think, like you said, I mean, her being girls and guys, I think are extremely different.
Right.
I think they were I just don't think maybe they were a little hard on her. I don't know. I mean, I think.
Well, they're Russian, so it's kind of hard not to be hard, right?
I mean, yeah, of course. From a culture standpoint, like, I would say it's probably looked at as being hard on, I mean, who knows, but, yeah, I think that they definitely, I can't really pinpoint anything. I think they did a lot of things similar, but I think they probably adjusted some of the ways that they coached me versus her. But from a standpoint of watching her, I mean, my sister has unbelievable work ethic, and she was always a role model for me growing up. So watching her on court and watching my parents with her and coaching her and what she did in tennis. And she was able to, through tennis, you know, earn a free education and get her master's and all that. And it definitely inspired me to pursue a career in tennis. And she is definitely someone I look up to every day.
So right now you said you're at a Futures. Where is that future tournament?
It's in Palm Coast. It's 25K in Palm Coast, Florida.
And tell us some of the names in it that we may know, and then also kind of walk us through playing these futures, what, you know, each day, what it looks like. Because what's funny to me, and a lot of the listeners may not have ever been to a future or a challenger, but we'll go to a future or challenger, and there'll be like 4 fans there. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, this is great, great tennis. And nobody's here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, actually Palm Coast, out of all of them, it's a pretty well attended future. It's funny that I say that, because well attended, I mean, there's like 20, 30 people watching. I mean, it's just all part of it. I mean, you really get to see who really, you know, loves the game. I mean, it's not easy being out here in futures, but it's definitely, if you want to make it to making money and and get to the top, it's something that you got to go through. So
yeah, it's on the ladder. You have to go up it. So
But there, I mean, very, very good players. I mean, especially this tournament is very strong. I mean, I played a guy first round who's ranked 320 or in the 300s. So he's a good player. I mean, there's plenty of guys. There's a guy who played lost first round. This guy Tatlot, who is a French guy, very strong junior. I think it was top five in the world. You got guys, like I said, the guy who won the French Open Juniors last year, lost first round.
What's his name? Is that that
Holger Rune?
Okay. Yeah.
You got the guy. There's a bunch of USDA kids. And Toby Kodat lost in the finals of French Open. Zvaida, he won Kalamazoo. Emilio Nava. Yeah. So I mean, a lot of those good juniors. Then you got guys who are, you know, a little bit older in the 300s, 400s.
Former college players.
Alex Richard went to Virginia. He's playing. You got Martin Redlicky, former number one college. Kipson. I mean that's just the Americans. Then you got guys.
That's a fantastic tournament.
Yeah, it's a great tournament. Yeah, it's a good field.
Yeah,
we had Scott. We had Patrick Kipson on.
Yeah, 20 episodes ago, didn't we? Episode 16. So check that one out.
we enjoyed that episode with Patrick. That is a great event. You're at a bunch of good players there.
Yeah, Kipson is a great guy.
Good. Let's see. So before we get back, we'll get to your pro career and what you're doing now. But growing up, did you have any injuries or struggles that you had to overcome?
I had a couple of. There's always kind of. I think when you're becoming a professional athlete and in college, there's always something that's kind of bothering you. Like you're never really 100%, but nothing extremely. I mean, knock on wood, nothing extremely major. At 17, I had a stress reaction in my knee, which is basically a step down from a stress fracture, so almost a stress fracture, and then had some, you know, tendonitis in my elbow and like tendonitis, bursitis in my shoulder in college, but. Nothing serious
that kept you out for
major.
No, nothing major. Okay, good. Yeah. You mentioned that you played some of the junior slams. Could you tell us, you know, which slams you played, how you did in them, and some of your takeaways from playing those tournaments?
Yeah, I played U.S. Open Juniors 3 times. My last year I made quarterfinals, lost to Taylor Fritz.
Okay.
Is
that when he won it?
Me. It was like 3-1, yeah.
Okay.
Then I played the French twice, second round both times, and then played Wimbledon once, made round 16. Decent results, but I love the junior slams. I definitely think, kids who are striving to be top juniors, definitely striving to play the slams. It's unbelievable experience. You get to, play on the same courts as the, main draw of the, the biggest tournaments in the world. And you get to see all the pros, all your favorite pros that you looked up to growing up. And, U.S. Open was always a great experience for me when I played it when I was 16. I got to warm up Federer, which was unbelievable. That gave me a lot of motivation.
How did that happen?
He was playing a lefty. He was playing Lopez or Manarino.
Okay.
My coach then, Diego Moyano, knew him, and he was looking for a lefty, and they set it up, and it was unbelievable.
So how nervous were you?
I was super nervous. Yeah, I was super nervous.
did you have a hard time getting, into a rhythm, or was it from the first ball you're okay?
I think the first ball that I hit, I was extremely nervous, but once I made contact with the first ball and then I was all right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Roger's pretty easy to hit with. I mean, he doesn't, especially when he's warming up, he's just kind of flowing through. And
Okay. Did he give you any advice, or did he give you any, you know, thing to...
I mean, he's just a super, super down-to-earth guy, especially with everything that he's accomplished, arguably the greatest of all time.
Sure.
I mean, he walked out on the court, was like, "Hey, how you doing? My name's Roger." And I was like, "Are you kidding me?" So, you know, that kind of stuff, like asking me how I'm doing.
Why didn't you give him one of these, like, Roger who? What's your last name?
Yeah, I should have, huh? Yeah, I should have. No, I was pretty starstruck in the moment, but
good.
Definitely one of the guys who I was, you know, been watching since I was a little kid, and having a one-hander and looking up to him. So yeah, getting to hit with him was really cool. And now that, you know, the next goal is to play him, you know, and
right, right. Well, he'll be around for another 10 years, so you got plenty of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us about what you're doing in college. Where are you? What are you doing? Tell us about your college experience just a little bit.
Yeah, so my college is done. Played 4 seasons at TCU.
Cool.
Loved every minute of it.
So why TCU? You're a Florida guy. You know, Fort Worth is not, you know, South Beach or whatever. why did TCU, you know, let's say you're number one recruit in the country. You could have went, you know, anywhere, yeah, obviously. Why TCU?
Yeah. I mean, so at that point, going to college, I actually really wanted to turn pro and not go to college. Mm-hmm. But once college came into the equation and I was looking at colleges, I was picking between a handful of schools, having the mindset of, okay, like, I'm going to go to college and then I'm going to turn pro and play pro after college. So that was always, yeah, my mindset, and having the handful of schools in mind, I was looking at the University of Florida, Wake Forest, and TCU. So those are the schools I visited. And I actually went to visit, Florida first. And I remember I visited and, you know, the guys were cool, and I hadn't really had any prior connection to the guys and the coaches, Brian Shelton, unbelievable guy. Mark Marklin, who was there at the time, was also unbelievable guy, and great coaches. And I the campus was like, I didn't really, it was good, solid. I knew they had a good school, and I called my mom and I said, "Hey, like, I think, you know, I'm just going to commit here. It's close to home." And she said, "Hey, why don't you just, you know, go to the other two schools and see, you know, have something to compare it to." And so I decided I was going to go. I went to Wake Forest and I went to TCU. And when I went to TCU, Roditi, I had kind of known Roditi from before. He was a USDA coach in Carson before he got to TCU. And one of the things that I always laugh about is, you know, you ask around people, you know, ask, hey, like, how's, you know, how are the coaches here? And how's Roditi? Or how's Brian? And one of the things about Roditi that I found crazy was I didn't hear one bad thing about the guy. So I was like, wow, this is crazy. You know, like, usually you get mixed opinions, but everyone loved him. Mm-hmm. So I went there and I fell in love with the school right away. The campus was beautiful. Facilities are great. Coaches I knew were great. I knew some of the guys before on the team, and I just decided, like, this is the place for me. So,
you know, we were actually at the Mississippi State match when y'all played at Mississippi State. What,
yeah,
back in May or June-ish?
Well, that was around a 16 match, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it was around 16, yeah.
Yeah, we were there. That was a fun match to watch. It was kind of up and down. You didn't know who was going to win, and y'all pulled it out.
Yeah.
It was
a great one. Yeah, it was unbelievable. The boys got me through it.
So talk about the coach. You know, he's an interesting guy wearing a big hat. And, you know, he's kind of – I love
yeah, he's
what he's on Twitter. He's got a big personality. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, huge personality. Super funny guy, super likable. Definitely, like, unbelievable tennis IQ, really good coach, and just a really good person in general. You know, I think we really hit it off, and he's really passionate about what he does, That's one of the things that that I like a lot about him is he really cares. He really cares about his players, and
right.
You know, me and Roditi and I still, you know, we still talk, and you know, when I'm in Fort Worth, I go and chat with him, and that's like my TC is like my second home, and it will be for always, you know. And he's
so
just,
do you go,
you know,
do you get,
he's just
do,
a great person.
Do you go back there much to train?
Yeah. So I'm still working a lot with Devin Bowen, who's a associate head there at TCU. He's been my main coach, and also just unbelievable person, great coach. And Devin and Roditi, both of those guys have really done a lot for me tennis wise and helping me grow as a person, and they are super important people in my life. And you know, Devin continues to be my coach and super highly involved in my tennis to this day. So hopefully that will continue.
So how would you say that your game has improved from the time that you got on campus to where you are now? You know, you say you gained 20 pounds, so I'm assuming that you know, you did a lot of, you know,
yeah.
conditioning,
yeah.
But you know, in terms, go ahead.
Yeah. I think definitely like, physically I'm a lot more fit than I was when I came into school. And game wise, I think in juniors, I loved playing on clay, and clay was my favorite surface, and it still is. But I think that, playing indoor hard, fast hard in college and playing on fast courts really helped me develop, I had like pretty big backswings and just like shoring up, learning mm-hmm. to play with less time and coming in and serving better, returning better. I think my serve and return have improved a lot in college. Yes. And mentally has been huge for me as well. I think mentally I've definitely gotten better over the past couple of years.
So is it a big change from, I'm sure it is a big change, but you know, in college, you know, you have a coach that's on the court with you, talking to you between points.
Yeah.
And then you go, you know, now you obviously you can't have that. So, you know, what kind of things, was Roditi always on your court, or was he say, I'm going to leave you alone because I know you got to think through these things, or what was his philosophy in terms of how involved he was going to be in your match?
Yeah, I think they, kind of went back and forth. I think sometimes I had Roditi, sometimes I had Devin. For my first 2 years, my freshman sophomore year, when Nori was there, Facundo Lugones, who's Nori's coach, traveling coach now on tour, he was always he was a volunteer assistant at the time. He was always in between me and Nori's court, so he has helped me as well. But I think they were pretty. They kind of let me do my thing, just super supportive. And I think Roditi and Devin, when they had, you know, things that they saw, like patterns that were occurring, you know, like, hey, this guy, you know, doesn't like the low slice to his forehand, or like, hey, like serve this guy in the body, like he hasn't been returning great. You know, they would come by and give me those little pieces of information. But other than that, they weren't over, you know, every point telling me certain things, and it was more support.
Yeah. You know, I think the whole college thing is interesting. The discussion of whether or not to go to college is interesting. And obviously you feel like you improved and you feel like you made relationships and it's something you wouldn't trade. But I think, personally, I think everybody who has the chance to go should go. But mm-hmm. I also noticed some of the, you know, there's only so much fire and fight and desire within every human, right? Every competitor, every athlete. And you know that some of those folks like Roger, you know, whatever his last name is, you know, the guy that you met that day, Roger Fett, his desire seems to have never waned, right? He still loves it.
Yeah.
You look at a guy like Tom Brady in his 40s, he still loves it. But then you can look at other athletes that when they're 22 years old, they're out of gas. They
They have talent, but they're sick of it. They're tired of it, right? And so I think one of the, for me, the interesting conversations on go to college or not go to college is some of the hungriest years of an athlete's life are the, that 18 to 22, where they're willing to just kill themselves and work. And so how would you say, you know, you probably showed up in college just fired up and ready to go. How would you say that your desire and energy in your tennis has changed? Do you see yourself like a Drew Brees who each year you feel like you're getting better and loving it more? Or do you feel like you know, what does that look like for you as far as your hunger and desire in the game?
Yeah, I mean, college tennis was definitely a different type of experience for me that I didn't really know what it was going to be like going in. Like I said, my parents grew up in Russia. They didn't, you know, they kind of had the mindset of, look, like, you're either playing tennis to make money or you're going to college for school. Like, you know, there's no going to college for, to become a pro. But, you know, as they saw me in college developing, and when I went to school, that kind of changed for them. And I, like I said, I wasn't even, I didn't really know much about college going into it. You know, I didn't play the fall. I came in January. I was kind of thrown into the dual match season and it was just different for me. You know, competing with guys next to me, my teammates who, you know, we put in the work together and coaches put in the work together. And it's, you know, you're not just playing for you. And I think that's really important to kind of realize. And I think I've kind of carried that with me to this day. And I've always wanted to play professional tennis at the highest level. And that mindset of remembering, you know, the purpose of when I go out on court, like it's not just, you know, I'm not just playing for myself. You know, I'm playing for, you know, my coaches and my parents and everybody who has sacrificed so much for me to get to where I'm at right now. And I think that helps me continue to be hungry and push myself. And
That makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, like you said you didn't really have much experience playing team events. Did you play many team events in juniors? You know, whether it's zonals or, you know, there's a few national team championships, but
no, I didn't. Play any of those.
There's nothing. Yeah. So, interesting. So where was the most hostile environment you guys played in when you played at TCU?
I think playing against Baylor.
Baylor's usually big the answer, rival. I think.
Yeah. What was that?
So Baylor's always the answer that comes up with that.
Yeah,
question,
Baylor's tough. Baylor's tough, but
Yeah.
I think we only want to say we lost to them. Yeah, we lost them twice when I was there.
Well, Scott, that also means we need to make it our way to a Baylor match, right? I mean,
they're intense. They're intense, especially Baylor TCU because they're big rivals.
And especially with us, I'm not sure you know anything about it, but I guess Jensen Brooksby originally committed to TCU, but then ended up at Baylor. So I'm sure that just adds some fuel to the fire.
Yeah, I definitely know about that.
We'll leave it at that, right?
Yeah.
Hey, so talk a little bit about, you know, the transition tour. You know, like you say, right now you're playing some futures. How has the new, you know, format helped or made it harder for you to transition into pro tennis?
I mean, they changed it back, so the futures have ATP points now. So they have a little bit less ATP points than they used to, but it's still beneficial to play futures. They're still moving up in the rankings.
Yeah, and so, you know, where's your current ranking right now?
I'm at 520.
520. And what sort of is the target line to get to so that you're getting into challengers. You know, like you say, we got a bunch of challengers coming up on the clay, which is, you know, good for you. Yeah. You know, in Savannah, Tallahassee, and
yeah,
you know, those tournaments.
To be in like 300s would be
okay.
Probably start playing more full schedule of challengers.
Yeah.
And so there's a really good. I was gonna say there's a really good challenger that has started up in Little Rock, and Scott and I went last year, but it maybe was in its first or second year last year.
Yeah, it was first year.
That would be a good. Well, it would be a good one to target because it's kind of hot, you know, and people avoid it because it's humid and hot and they're sweating. It's kind of Florida, South Florida weather in the summer, right? What was funny was when we went last year, a lot of the California guys and Northern guys were just dying, cramping. And I thought the Southeast guys had an advantage, right? So that would be a good one. If you can get into that one, we'll probably go again. And we brought our boys and they had a good time watching. And let me ask this question is, as you're playing your matches, how much are you thinking about where your place serves? So how much are you thinking like, okay, I'm going to go to their backhand flat, or I'm going to go to the body slice, or I'm going to go kick to the forehand or backhand? How much are you thinking about and noticing, you know, I've hit slice to the body twice, they missed them both, so I'm going to come back with that at an important add-in point? How much is that a thought in your head, or do you just say, you know, right here, I'm going to hit a flat down the tee and hope it's an ace? What's your thought process there?
I would say it's definitely like starting the match with my patterns. I mean, like I'm going to my favorite serves of where I want to serve. And then as the match goes along, noticing what's bothering my opponent, which serves they don't like, and then trying to use those more. But definitely, like big points sticking to my favorite serves, no matter what the, you know, how good the guy's return is.
And so if it's an add-in point and you're trying to hold, that you're going to go to the serve that you have a high percentage that you feel real good about rather than...
Yeah, correct.
You know, say you're on the add side and you've gone out wide three times, you don't think, all right, right here I'm going down the tee because he won't be expecting it. Instead, you're going with that one that you know you're going to make.
I mean, I think... Most of the time I'm going with my favorite serve. If like I've noticed that the guy, let's say, you know, this six times or four times or whatever that I've went body forehand or I've went tee, he's missed the return, then I would consider going, you know, to that spot again if I know that he doesn't like that serve. If that makes sense.
And so and I'm asking real detailed questions, but it's interesting to me. What kind of player and game style would you say you are? We watched a guy at the Challenger while we were in Little Rock, and he came out first set guns blazing, won like 6-2, and out physically who he's playing. It was just ridiculous. He was just hitting through him. And second set, though, you know, he was from up northeast. So second set, he started wearing down.
But he played at Baylor, if you want a hint of who that is.
Yeah, he did play at Baylor. That's right. And so second set, he starts wearing down. And I can't – who, Scott, who was he playing? Was he playing Duty Sala?
No, I don't know who he was playing.
He was playing kind of a counterpuncher, you know, guy that's not super powerful, but it almost looked like the guy was rope-a-doping, you know, and kind of letting him wear himself out. And so they go to a tie break in the second set and the other guy wins. And then the third set was a blowout. So it was just amazing to see the first set look so different from the third set just out of, you know, what Scott? You said he almost looked like a thoroughbred, you know, horse.
Yeah, right.
In that
right.
first set.
Yeah.
How would you say your game style is, and how often has something like that either happened to you? You were on the losing side or the winning side, where the first set was just a blowout. You either won or lost, and then it flip flopped. How much has that happened to you, and what's your game style in that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say my game style particularly is I'm an all-around player. Just like to build the point. And I mean, I don't have like a huge serve. I think I rely on like placing my serve and hitting my spots well, but I would say I rely on my serve and forehand, building the point, coming in, trying to finish the points around the net, move well, play good defense. Yep. So kind of like an all around player, but yeah, I mean, that's for sure happened. I mean, that's happened to everybody. I think, you know,
can you give us an example in college where you lost a match that way? And then another example where you won one that way? I know I'm putting you on the spot.
Let me think.
I just think it's interesting, especially for like our kids listening to this, because watching that match live was great for my son, because he's kind of the kid that gets overpowered, but he could play tennis all day. And so if he can just kind of fight for that second set, the third set's easy because he can play all day. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember there was a match last year that I lost that I played a really, really good first set, then got down a break early in the second because I lost focus, and then the third set I was tired and I lost easy. So,
so when you say you lost focus, you won that first set and you were like dialed in, and then that second set came along, and just that, like, how 30-second loss of focus, a minute loss of focus, and it cost you that game. I mean, what was it?
A couple loose points, you get broken, then you're down a break, and then you're fighting to get back in the set. You lose a set, and then third set gone.
Yeah, and like I say, when you say you lose focus for a second with no ad on your serve, you know, it's huge. So, I mean, ad scoring, it's, you know, every game you've got to be dialed in, or else they can go pretty fast.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, I mean, there was a match at National Indoors against one of my really good friends who he, you know, was outplaying me for a set and a half, and I was down a set, and I think maybe a break, and I just stuck with it and kept fighting, had a lucky break, and won the second 7-6, and then ran away with it in the third.
You know, and that's so interesting, like, how old were you when you could find the ability to just keep fighting, right? I mean, you were down a set and a break, and instead of just mailing it in, you just kept fighting. At what age did that kind of happen to you? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's something that you're taught from a young age. Don't give up, you know. It's easier said than done, but, you know, don't give up. Right. You always keep fighting, and I think it's also good to know that, you know, you can be down. Momentum in tennis can change, like, in one point, you know. You can be down setting a break, or the guy's serving for the match. You break, and then you win the second, and now it's even. I mean, I can tell you, you know, so many matches where I've been down a set and a break, or a set and, you know, 5-2, and you hang in there and you never know what can happen.
If you play enough, you're going to have those situations where you lose a set 6-0, and then it's a new set, and, you know, suddenly you're up 2-0 in the second set, and then now you feel comfortable, you feel confident, and you end up winning the second set, and then you're playing a third set, and it's all even. But it's the first time to ever do that is a big thing. You know, with my son, he played his tournament, you know, a few months ago, and he lost the first set 6-0, and he'd never come back from that before. He threw his racket and got, you know, a point penalty, so he started the second set down, you know, love 15, ended up winning that game. Then he wins the next 5 games, and he wins the second set real easy. And it was just, until you do that, you know, it's always talk, but you've got to put them in those situations. You've got to, you know, be out there so that you do have that situation where you do you actually go through it physically, so you know that you can do it, as opposed to just being someone saying, well, you know, you just got to keep fighting, you know, a second set's just a new set. But you've got, you know, sooner or later you will do it. But until you do it, it's all in theory, and it's hard to do. But
yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it's definitely easier said than done. And I mean, right. I can't. There's no certain moment that I remember where I like was down in a match and then came back, and then, you know, that changed everything for me. And now I knew I could come back. And so, you know, I was just always taught from a young age, like, to fight and compete. And I was always a good competitor, and never really thought about, you know, I'm not saying I haven't like mailed the matches in, but, you know, never really a thought for me to just tank and just not try, you know. It's just not really what I'm about.
Let's say you lost the first set 6-0, and you did like Luke's son, and you threw your racket, and you got the point penalty. How are your parents going to react to that, right? Because Scott and I talk about this a lot. When you're dealing with competitive kids, they're going to do stupid things. And you can't just like say, well, you're done with tennis for a year, right? You gotta teach them and then put them back in that situation again and teach them and put. So what was your parents, knowing that your parents were, you know, I would say conservative Russian people, right? You've described that on the podcast up to this point. How did they react when you did that?
Yeah, I mean, it's unacceptable. I mean, it's tough, like, to say, because I've definitely been there. I mean, I've definitely thrown my racket and broken rackets, and I've been that kid. You know, I've still, I mean, to this day, I have my moments for sure. But like you said, I think, you know, you can't just say like, oh, you're done with tennis. I think there's certain things that my parents would, you know, explain to me, and, you know, I'd be, whether it's like getting grounded or like taking away something, or I think in general, just seeing like my parents upset with me and telling me and instilling in me that this is not the right thing to do and this is not the right way to behave. And
And so have you ever been, you know, pulled off the court for anything that you've done, or has it always been, hey, we'll deal with it?
I've never been pulled off the court, no, but, I mean, I've had matches in college where my attitude and behavior was extremely poor and you know, at that point, it just kind of like letting down. It's just kind of different. Yeah. It's different things that you don't realize when you're 12 years old. It's like, you know, you throw your racket, you're not like, oh man, like, you know, letting my parents down or something. You know, that just doesn't go through your mind when you're 12, but when you're in college and like you lose a match know part of the reason that you lost that match is because, you know, you didn't have your attitude was got in the way of the way you played. And then, you know, all of a sudden you're sitting there and you lost the match and your team lost the match and you're like, oh shoot, you know. Like, that doesn't feel good.
Because it's, you know, like you say, it's a lot bigger than you at that point. So
exactly.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's important. Parents struggle with this. It's and I would say this is a real common parenting thing in tennis. But parents struggle with the fact that little kids aren't robots, right? You can't say stop, and then they just stop because you told them to stop.
Yeah, exactly.
It's exactly what you said. It's they do it. You punish them. You have discussions with them, they reflect on it, and that cycle happens repeatedly over and over and over until probably forever. I mean, like you said, you were in college still having that self-reflection about it. But the only kids I know who don't cry and who don't throw their racket and who don't get upset in a match are the ones that aren't competitive, that don't really care if they win or not. You know what I'm saying? And so I'd much rather have a kid that's super competitive who I got to tell stop throwing your racket or, you know, whatever, rather than a kid who you're saying,
well, just keep trying, you know, like kids who don't try, who just don't really care if they're good or not, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. 100%.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Scott?
Hey, well, I was just going to say we should probably try to wrap it up here. We're getting a little bit past our time, but I wanted to ask you a few quick, you know, fast feed type questions. And these will be, you know, you can answer it however you want to, but just want to get your sort of reaction to some names that I'll throw out here. See if they have any meaning for you. But
that's really good at these. I'm sure these names are going to be like your cousin, some aunt. I mean, he's really good at this.
No, I didn't go.
So you want like one word answers, or you want like just whatever?
Whatever comes to your mind. It can be one word, or it can be, you know, more than that. So, you know,
I'm looking forward to that as much as you are.
Okay. Well, one of the tragic things that happened recently was the death of Kobe Bryant. You know, he's sort of an icon for he transcends all sports. What did Kobe Bryant mean to you as a competitor and an athlete?
Yeah, Kobe. I feel like when Kobe passed away in the news, it was just crazy. It's like kind of like the world stopped. Like everyone was like, what, you know, like I was like refreshing Twitter to see if there was news of like, oh, you know, just false reports, you know, like it's okay. It's just one of those things where he's such a legend and such an iconic guy, and you know, it's more than just a person. It's like his like Mamba mentality. It's like a whole, it's like a culture, you know. And him, he's like the epitome of hard work and dedication and putting hours in the gym and putting hours on the court, and that's the final product. So I looked up to Kobe for sure. He wasn't someone who was, you know, like my favorite player and like always my role model, but definitely he's one of those guys who you look up to and you're like, wow, like, you know, you really put in the work, this is what you can get. So him passing away is definitely a shock to the whole, not just basketball players, but the whole athletic community and people who aspire to be professional athletes. Just crazy. Sure.
There's so much. He did so much in terms of, you know, motivation and desire and being a, you know, a positive role model for young athletes. And so just, there's so much material out there that, you know, we watched a lot of that in the days after his passing, and, you know, try and, you know, pass a lot of that on to my son, because, you know, that, you know, the way that he approached life and his craft and his game was, you know, if you can, doesn't really, he never really said he was to be the best basketball player, but it was be the best basketball player that he could be. And I think that's sort of what I try to tell my son is, you know, it's, whether or not you're a pro, that's not going to determine whether or not you're successful. If you become the best tennis player, the best athlete, the best person you can be, then you're successful. So I think that's something that I took away from that. Yeah. So, all right, next one. Saw you in Knoxville with Tommy. You weren't playing, but you were there. What were you there, you know, coaching him that week, or were you there just as a hitting partner? And what's your relationship with Tommy?
Yeah, Tommy's one of my best friends. Been best friends for a while, you know, since we were 15, 16 years old. He, great person, means a lot to me. But in Knoxville, I was there specifically. I was just trying to get into the tournament and play. And the following week, I was going to Madrid for Davis Cup. So that was kind of like my last tournament before I ended the year. And me and Tommy were housing together and hoping to get into doubles, hoping to get into singles, and neither of those ended up happening.
but Knoxville in November, so that's not too bad.
Exactly. But yeah, Tommy's like a brother to me, and it's really great seeing him having the results he's having. It's been a long time coming, for sure.
For sure. Yeah, we talked to him a little bit at the tournament, and you had a really good conversation with him. He's a funny guy, a great personality, and like you say, you know, great to see him having that success, and, you know, especially what he did in the Australian Open, you know, you can sort of see the guy's ready to break through. You know, he's had a good win against Dimitrov, and hopefully, you know, he continues you know, maintain his, where he is in the rankings, so he's not, you know, struggling to, you know, get in these tournaments again. But I think, you know, the more he plays that level, the better, you know, results he's going to, are going to come his way.
Right. 100%. Right.
Yeah. And our buddy, TJ Pura, who is, I think you know him as a relationship coach, right?
Yeah, TJ is a great guy. TJ has helped me a lot with relationship advice for sure, but me and him, we didn't really know each other. We didn't really know each other that well in the juniors, but, you know, him and Tommy are really close, and me and Tommy are really close, so we kind of got acquainted through that, and I've known him for a little bit as well, but we've definitely gotten closer over the past couple months. Yeah, he's helped me through a bit. But yeah, just listening to his podcast with you guys and listening, just knowing him and talking to him and his mindset, just going by life is awesome. And
yeah, he's awesome. Totally agree. And, yeah,
and
he's
I think
a good
that
person
for sure. And I think that young kids and parents as well, just listening to the podcast with him, of you guys talking to him and the way he goes about his daily life, whether it be tennis, whether it be his job, whether it just be life in general, I think there's a lot of things that a lot of people can take from it.
Yeah, good. And what about, one more here, Diego Maiano. I know you said that he was your coach when you were at USTA.
Yeah, absolute beast.
I saw him practice a few times. But he's a heck of a player too, right?
Yeah, he was also, you know, big part of my tennis and very appreciative of everything that he's done for me. He's not really involved in my tennis at the moment, but he's also, you know, I've been blessed to have some great people in my life, and he was also one of them, and we still talk a little bit, but he's just a machine, man. I mean, the guy is just, just nonstop on court. Just a hard worker, puts everything into his coaching, and definitely someone beneficial to have in your corner. I mean, that guy can just go all day. Like, talk about someone who can go all day. He is an unbelievable, just an absolute machine.
Awesome. He's coaching Kevin Anderson right now, right?
Kevin. Yeah.
Wow. So that's a big change from going from, you know, Tommy to Kevin Anderson. So much different style of game and different type of player.
Yeah.
But yeah, sure. I've nothing but good things about him.
Yeah, yeah. And I think he just, like, in general, he just loves tennis. Like, loves
yeah.
tennis. You know, like,
yeah,
he could talk tennis with you all day, and he, you know, has seen a lot of things, been with a lot of players, played himself, right. You know, been through a lot.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he's just, loves it.
Excellent. All right. Hey,
well,
this was a ton of
fun. Yeah, we really enjoyed it.
But let me ask you one last question, then we'll let you go. But tell us your racket, your string, and your tension.
I play with the Babolat Aero VS Tour.
Okay.
It is.
Is that an three. Older frame?
Yeah, they're actually coming out with a new one soon, okay. Next couple of months. So the VS Tour weighs 345 grams.
Cool.
Strong. I play with Luxalon Alu Power 16 gauge.
Okay.
Gray.
Okay. Okay.
Man.
46 pounds.
46. Okay.
46. And you've never been
pounds.
Injured. That's unreal, man.
Yeah, 46 pounds, black stencil.
black stencil.
Little rubber band for the vibration damper.
Okay. Okay, so, the rubber band. All right, I like it.
Yeah.
What size grip?
Four and a quarter.
Four and a quarter. All right. That's a big frame.
Yeah,
weight.
I'll say.
Five.
I mean, it,
yeah,
It's a paddle to go.
That's a man's racket right there.
That's a man's racket, right, man. I can't believe your shoulder it can handle that thing. That's impressive.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, Alex, thanks a lot. Good luck tomorrow. We'll keep an eye on you and at this tournament. What tournament do you have coming up after this?
I'm playing this and then 25K in Naples and then Columbus Challenger and then Las Vegas 25K.
Okay, nice. Great. Columbus Challenger. We might make it up for Columbus. That's not too far from us. But good luck with all that. Tell George we said hello. We spoke to George a couple years ago at the NCAAs in Athens, Georgia. And
yeah, we did. Didn't
he's
we?
He's a good guy. So tell him we said
yeah,
hello.
He's a great guy. Yeah, we'll do.
All right, Alex. Thanks.